good afternoon. It is a few seconds after 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock on CFRC 101.9 FM. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And I'm just trying to find my got lots of things loaded up here, trying to find my USB so I can load up my programs. Let's see what we got here. Here we go. Anyway, coming up on the show today, we do have two book launches. And in the first hour, you'll hear from an October 10th launch and reading event at Novel Idea Bookstore. In it, you'll hear Linda Wild, her book, The Weight of Two Oranges, and Calista Markatich with Wrap in a Big White Towel. And both of them read from their books, both debut collections, both released this year. And Rena Ubitas moderated the event. In the second hour, from an October 17th launch event at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Arthur W. Gulakson launching his latest book, The Defeat and Attrition of the 12 SS Panzer Division, Hitler Jugend, Volume 1, The Normandy Bridgehead Battle 7 through 11, June 1944. And I'm sorry if I mispronounced any of that. But before we start, I just want to say you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. And just the usual hourly announcement, it is that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show is played in its entirety. It does have strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. So let's go ahead and move into, and this will pretty much consume the first hour, move into the October 10th, again, launch and reading event. In case you tuned in a minute or too late and didn't hear it, you're going to hear Linda Wild with her book, The Weight of Two Oranges, and Calista Markatich with her new book, Wrap in a Big White Towel. Again, both books are debut collections from each poet and were released this year. And I think the first voice you'll hear is that of Rena Ubitas, who moderated and emceed the event that evening. Let's go ahead and just jump right into it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Smart. Positive.
Yeah. Where's Amanda?
Is Amanda?
Yeah. Pippi Longstockings. It doesn't have to be the Wicked Witch of the East.
That's right.
That's the other choice.
Nobody else will understand what you're saying.
I understand.
That's an earlier conversation.
And it's quite a frightening thing that apparently we do know what this is about.
Yes, scary.
Good evening. My name is Rena Ubitas, not Pippi Longstockings, nor the Wicked Witch of the East, and I'll be moderating tonight's readings by two beloved Kingstonians. We have the privilege of gathering here this evening on the traditional homelands of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and Huron-Wendat nations. I'm grateful that we have this space to share poetry and fellowship, pursuits which I expect resonate deeply with traditional cultures around the world. Mary Oliver reminds us that poetry and storytelling are among the most ancient of art forms and that their roots are within the original wilderness of the earth. We are grateful also for the extraordinary ways in which Oscar and Joanna and Novel Idea support poets with events like this one. Kingston is truly blessed with a community that celebrates its local writers so beautifully, and that we can do so in a setting where words and books and writers and ideas collide and are honored. Rita Dove, the first African-American poet laureate, said that poetry is language at its most distinct distilled and most powerful form. You will hear many powerful words this evening from my friends, Calista Markotich and Linda Wild. Linda and I met first, but only by a hair, some 40 years ago when I was looking for a country home, and by good fortune, I picked her as my realtor. She found me a dilapidated, condemned stone schoolhouse in the village of Yarker, and I have lived there ever since. Although I'm happy to report that the home that I live in is no longer condemned. Callie and I met a few months later at Linda's suggestion when I said that I wanted to put together a writing group, and Linda had a notion that Callie might be interested. And so the three of us, along with a changing cast of several other writers, met for many years, irregularly, but always with gusto and good food. Although a decade sometimes slipped by without a meeting of our group, we stayed connected through other art making and all kinds of adventures, including wilderness escapades in the dark of winter, which terrified Callie's husband, Don, and pinhole photography, which was equally terrifying to Linda's electricians and construction workers, and furniture making with bits of willow. Callie and Linda resumed their work as writers together every Tuesday morning some years ago, maybe three or four. And the fruits of their labors are partly borne out in the two collections that they will read from this evening. We'll begin with Callie's book, Wrap in a Big White Towel. In case you haven't seen it, and in case you don't have a copy yet, there's some up here. And this book was published recently by Frontenac House. Callie was a finalist for the 2023 Gwendolyn McEwen Poetry Prize, and she has been nominated for the Pushcart and National Magazine Awards. Callie is a contributing editor for ARC Poetry Magazine. Poet Lorna Crozier, who gave me these stockings, which are not Wicked Witch of the East, but Pippi Long stockings. Lorna claims that this is a collection with warm intelligence, the kind that can only be found in poetry. The sure and elegant writing transports the reader to a place of blood and bone knowing, where memory and grief and gratitude for past and future blessings reside. I love these poems. Their impeccable but easygoing formality, their range, their perfectly played music, meant not only for the ear, but also for the heart. End quote. Linda Wild is both a photographer and a poet. Her debut collection, The Weight of Two Oranges, and in case you don't have a copy yet, you'll see it here too, is published by Wintergreen Studios Press. Linda divides her time between Kingston and Oaxaca. Her work has been published in literary journals throughout Canada and the U.S. The Weight of Two Oranges is a collection of poems and photographs inspired by these two places. The rocks, trees, and lakes of eastern Ontario, and the semi-arid high desert landscape of the Oaxaca Valley in Mexico. Poet Susan Haldane claims that the rich imagery of Linda Wild's language combines with her spare, stunning illustrations into a poetry of contrasts. The familiar with the exotic, ice with color, quiet pleasures with vivid memories and dreams. We will hear first from Callie's collection, followed by Linda's reading. Each of our writers will speak for roughly 15 minutes. And even though I'm sure you will be tempted, can I ask you to hold your applause until each writer has finished her reading? After that, we'll open the floor to comments and questions before rounding out the evening with a stroll around Novel Idea for some bedtime reading to take home with you. And books by both authors, as I've already mentioned, are available, and I'm sure they'd be happy to sign your copies. So please join me in welcoming Calista Markotic.
Thank you so much. Hi. Thanks very much for coming tonight. It's really great to see you. I think people who like poetry must have friendly, responsive faces, because that's what I see, and it really helps. I decided to read some different ones tonight, and I'm glad I did, because at least one person is here on repeat, plus my husband. And I decided to read poems that are set here in this town, in this city. A few of them are set in the environments outside the city, but they're all local poems. So those are the ones I've chosen. And the first one is set at the Holiday Inn, when it was the site for Writer's Fest. Yes. And it was in particular a presentation by Michael Crummy about his book, The Innocents. Mm. And the room was really restless because of the theme of that rather challenging book. And my editor insisted that his favorite titles tell everything that's in the poem. So the title is the longest poem I have. It's called, the longest title I have, Michael Crummy Promotes His Book, The Innocents, at the Kingston Writers' Fest. We were in Salon A, a raft of well-brunched literati, hoping he'd throw us a line. The angst slapped around the room, dark spindrifts rocking us, his novel with the shifting dead weight of taboo. Incest. All the salt in the Newfoundland Sea can't scour or season this. We were afraid we'd slip undone. The orphan children wash apart. We caught the line he threw. Hand over hand, he hauled us into the tale that had cast its anchor in him. Innocence. The innocents. He pled their case. He sold his book. He hauled our raft ashore with all the orphan's cargo. Hunger. Toil. Cold, cod, seal, a clutch of their dead parents' sketchy truisms. I read the book as if to make safe harbor of myself. Three chapters in, I lay the innocents face down on the white, white tile, run a bath, hot, as if to balm the children, gray with grime, their hands and faces dark from ocean's whip and weather's burn. I wrap in a big white towel, clear a fist-shaped oval on the steamy glass. Through mist, I see my mirrored self. The children wrestle their resources in the pages that I turn. Courage, humor, a few small mercies. Love, like tidal confusions, like the sea, dangerous, generous, lone hope of survival. Page by page, I lift my cargo, a flick of understanding, heartload of compassion, the heft of ink on paper in which two orphans scrape a harsh, harsh life, the weight of them pressing me deep in a big, soft chair. So that was the Holiday Inn, and that was the Writer's Fest session. This one is set, it's set at Cathedral School, corner of Barry and Johnson. And it's a school I went to when I was a kid, which is getting to be, you know, a long time ago. And it just happens that my husband also went to school there. I didn't know him there. My sister went to school there. My grandchildren went to school there. And briefly, I was principal there. So it has a history, but this is an old history. One thing is, I call it a red brick school. I was probably sort of a, you know, KCBI wannabe there, but the red brick was a lot more symphonic in the poem than a limestone lookalike school. So I had to put it in there. And it's called, it was set at the time of the Hungarian Revolt, and it's called Refugee Kids. They came, revolt-born boy and girl, see-through pale, pounded thin by fight and flight from Hungary, to our Ontario red brick school with a violin and the clothing on their backs. In our gym of sweat and tears, where the warriors bash the lancers, where sock hops turned sexy when Liz slow danced Eugene, we witnessed them, Caroli and Giselle, in two large threads donated by Abramskys, assembled for freedom, ah, freedom, blue sky high and ether cool, flowing far above our true north heads as we twitched on folding chairs, girls saddle-shoed and kitten-sweatered, boys high-topped and trousered with 15-inch drapes. A nudge, a note to me, tight-folded. Jol, my sister, two rows back. Looks just like your skirt. My circle skirt with the poodle applique. It was just like my skirt. Falling from Giselle's small frame, without a crinoline, the poodle's sculpted head hung beside its pom-pom tail, the poodle's, its pert Parisian body, secret in the circle's bias folds. I'd never let Jol borrow it. More than once I'd yanked it from her hands. No, give it back, it's mine. I saw Giselle stare bravely dead ahead into the freedom of our gym and straight on through to Budapest. I saw Caroli raise the violin as if a sacrament and plead with each hard pull across the strings, thin with sorrow, thick with sob. I wasn't a kid. I'd poured a beer by now. I'd seen how out of nowhere it froths and foams and silently overflows the glass and pools out on the table. That's what my heart did. Loose from my cotton-bound 32A chest, it pounded like footsteps through rubble, pushed by danger, fear, the rush of people fleeing. It throbbed like Caroli's violin crying out this song. It swelled with a need to do something grand. What came to mind? What came to mind? So I was, after all, a kid. I'd wait for Jol to ask me for the skirt again. I'd place it in her hands. Here you are, I'd say. You're welcome.
Oh, that's lovely.
And this one is, it's the only, really the only one of two poems in here that makes any social comment, which is always a risk because sometimes there isn't an easy answer for the things that trouble us. But I thought I'd read it tonight because it's very much a part of our urban landscape here. It's called Carts. A metro castaway. A rickety cash basket clatters on its canted wheels up Queen Street. The man's hard push curves him like a hook over the grime-rimed handlebar. It holds his stuff. He keeps his hold on it. In my living room, at my laptop, ether cart, icon cart, flashing fun and folly, facile jaunt into an infinite bazaar, everything available. Simply glide, click, add to cart, the thing wanted, needed, cute. The wire cage hobbles on the sunset street, heavy with goods the man has found, slashed rubber boots, balled up clothes, a balding Barbie doll and mildewed books, a fake poinsettia, beer cans in a bag. My night house hums its ambience to the cell phone on the nightstand. Its sleeping screen holds products always ready for the cart to be bubble wrap boxed and jostled to a big front door. The cart lurks in some dank stairwell for daylight's rites of gather and get. On hard ground beside it, the man cocoons in a musty coat. It holds his stuff. It keeps its hold on him. A car light sweeps across them, glints in Barbie's open eye. Oh yes, and this one is more in the landscape. Part of the landscape is on Wolf Island, where my son and daughter-in-law and their little kids have cabins. And the other part of it is actually close to Wintergreen, where Rena has her her retreat. And it's called Off the Grid. Mm-hmm. Off the Grid. In March, a little boy was lost just north of here. He was 3. We could not sleep thinking of him in the bush alone. The second night, a storm crashed through. His coat and boots were blue. The woods in March don't show much blue. Through bare branches sky, long reaches of the northern lakes, its winter's lichened grays prevail, and deep black angles in stony cliffs. Child of my child, so like that boy, I follow your small back through brush and bracken. Grapevine, thick as a constrictor, arcs from tree to wind-bleached grass. Under you go, delighted. You loop through twice this bridge of wonder, mystic arch. We see a snake. You crouch on yellow rain boot heels and watch the sensing tongue. We hear the splashing skip of buffleheads and wend that way to see their crystal trail in the morning sun. From the limestone shelf, you point west along the waterfront, announce your house is over there. There's a winter-faded cottage and a cabin painted red, but then the ledge turns and climbs steep above the bay. Child, you wouldn't get home this way. I clasp your sturdy ribs and hoist you, small, compact form in your jacket of bright blue. A quarter turn and in the bush, south of where you thought it was, we find your house, the gable end, a wedge of white, filigreed by skeleton trees and underbrush. The creek bed that we'd followed cut oblique across our trail, tricked our sense of how things lie, and when we came upon a trammel track, our usual way, our feet were caked with mud, and for a second, we were lost. 3 days it was when searchers saw some blue, they said. They thought he was asleep. Asleep. Oh, please, asleep. Then trembling in their arms. That night, we weren't scared of the dark. We slept. I dreamt of blue. Secret bulb of gentian. Elusive flit of jay. Indigo bunting, tilting song into the blackbird's sharp spring call. And the last one is just, it's not so much that it's local, it is. It's happened. It could happen on any lawn in Kingston, Ontario. But the reason I read this one is because one of my daughters insists that I should read this one each time. And so this is the repeat one. It's called Narcissus of the Avians. Part of it's set in the house we lived in on Dog Lake. The other part, I suppose, is set on any number of green lawn in spring. A frenzied robin flaps and flails in excrement he's dropping on the sill. I can't put this robin in a poem for my mother. Alive, my mother flinched at words like shit. Yet it would flout the truth to leave unnamed what cakes the walkout windowsill. The glass, a wingtip struck montage of dust and chaff and ordure smears. Alive, my mother loved robins, how they hop on twiggy legs. Their pert head tilt towards the turf, the quick extraction of a worm, their nesting husbandry. But this one unsheathes talons now, thus so does that one in the glass. Cockfighters, they are equal, this one and that, mirrored in the window, matching rage, matching peck to vicious peck. This mate forsakes his family for the robin in the glass. Cannot break the spell. Huffed, affronted, neither does he sweetly kiss the image that exposes him unworthy, bellicose bird of spring. I want to write a robin poem, remembering my mother, remembering her call, her voice, every March, that special day in early March, her lovely, optimistic voice. I have seen a robin, dear. Mm-hmm. Mom, this is not that robin. Hi, everybody. It's great to see you. Lovely to be here tonight. I first of all want to thank Rena. She didn't mention that she is the publisher of this book. Her Wintergreen Studios Press, and I couldn't be happier with the production. It's she really turned it into a beautiful slim volume. So thank you, Rena.
You're welcome.
And I just want to thank Callie also, because as Rena said, we write together. We don't write together. We critique each other's work every Tuesday morning. And I always look forward to those Tuesday mornings. It's one of my favorite times to spend time with Callie and have her wise critique. So this book goes between Kingston and Eastern Ontario and Oaxaca. And it goes there both with words and with photographs. And I also want to acknowledge Richard Martin, who's here tonight, because I've gone to wonderful workshops with Richard, and I'm always inspired by his work. I'll just show you some of the photographs, just so you get an idea. For years, I got interested in photography about the same time that I got interested in Oaxaca, which was about 25 years ago. And one of the reasons was because Oaxaca is so colorful. And this image is an example of Oaxaca colors. But then I got, in the last two or three years, I've been doing more black and white photography. And I'd invite you to just come up and sort of go through the book and see some of the photographs if you like. You probably can't see them too well at this distance. But I just thought that they might work well with some of the poetry I was working at. So I'm going to start in Oaxaca in the Zocalo. And the Zocalo is the center of town in a Mexican town. All Mexican towns have them. And it's a place where people come to eat and drink and meet their friends and listen to music and to dance. And this little piece is about a dance. And it was written a long time ago. El Danzón, which is the dance. I am in the Zocalo tonight. On Wednesday nights, a marimba band assembles and old folks gather to dance. They dress in finery and move sedately with carefully choreographed steps. An audience watches. I am seated on a stone wall, observing intently, when I feel a tap on my shoulder. It is an elderly man. Will I dance with him? No, thank you. I am in casual clothes and shy of lights and an audience and unfamiliar dance steps. He persists. I'm sorry. I try to explain. I can't. Why not? He is puzzled. Is there something wrong with your heart? I leave soon after and walk home wondering if there is something wrong with my heart. It's December 20th, the shortest day of the year. I could have spent part of it dancing. This one is set between Kingston or any small Eastern Ontario town and Oaxaca or probably any Mexican town with a market, and all Mexican towns have great markets. And sorry, I'm on the wrong one. It's called The Weight of It. I see her tossing a small melon into the air. Not high, just high enough to get a good feel for the weight of it when it lands back in the spread of her palm. She is young, perhaps 18, standing in a chilled grocery aisle, but she could be in the warm patch of a garden. She tosses it two or three times, assessing its weight, its worthiness, before placing it in her cart. She is dark-skinned in a store where mostly white hands reach and touch tentatively, as one does in a small, waspish Ontario town. She will have a good life, I think. She has been schooled by someone who understands the wisdom of weight, what it means to be solid in the world. When I ask for a melon in the market in my Mexican town, the vendor inquires as to when I will eat it, selects one and lifts it in both hands like the Eucharist, draws it near to his face, and with eyes closed, inhales its aroma. And like the young woman, melon rested firmly in her palm, his hands rub the rough skin, handle the heft of it, know the worth of its weight. Mm-hmm. This is called Oriole, and when the Orioles leave here and migrate south, you probably know they go to the northern part of South America. And then on their way back, they come through Oaxaca. So that's always like a joyful sign for me that it's time to go home. And so I eventually go home, and they're still on their way, and I wait for them to come to my garden. Oriole. I returned early this year, pushed north by a pandemic, to wait while you moved up the continent at your own pace. Impatient, I placed orange halves among the lilacs to lure you to my garden. I sip spring wine and watch through thin May days while the sun angles north and the ghost of my neighbor comes down the garden path to admire your orange flash, and forgetting that she is dead, ask why I am waiting alone.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is set in Kingston, right here along King Street, in August when the lake goes that beautiful green and the weather gets very hot. Through the glass. There is a time of year when the lake goes green, the opaque green of pale jade. In late afternoon, the sun washes the green, wind-blown surface with a layer of pearl. These are the dog days, the days you forget until summer slows, and you recall again that it will end. The Great Lake is finally warm enough for swimming. Soon, pickerel will run beneath the moon. Old loves will occupy the mind, and for a brief time you will forget that there is any other kind of day but this one. I thought I saw you again today, the clothes, the gait, the person you were. I strained to see through the glass, but light bounced off the lake and I was pushed on by traffic. I adjusted the rear view mirror, tried once more for a glimpse of you. And this is called Los Antepasados. And the antepasados are the ancestors, all those who have gone before us. And you probably know that this is very important to Mexicans. The antepasados come back for the Day of the Dead, for the Dia de los Muertos. And in my neighborhood, and I think probably in every house in Oaxaca, people have an altar or a table
where they lay out goodies for the dead that come back. And it's things that they loved, like mole and chocolate and mezcal. And then they put tapetes on the floor, these carpets, so the dead can stretch out and have a rest before they go to the feast. And they have haras, which are jugs of water, so that they can refresh themselves. This is followed by a shorter poem called Semana Santa. And Semana Santa, of course, is Holy Week, the week before Easter. Los Antepasados. Mexicans are famous for the close, unembarrassed connection they maintain with their dead, for home altars laden with food and drink for the ancestors as they return for Dia de los Muertos, for the tapetes spread out for rest after the journey home, for haras of cool water set out for refreshing before the celebrations. I was a small child running my finger over names carved in black marble. My father took me to this place on Sundays after Mass, after he went to his garden, cut an armful of gladioli, and placed them in a pail for me to hang on to as we went to the cemetery. I knew his parents only from black and white photographs. They looked very old. In truth, they died quite young. My father trimmed the gravesite while I carried the faded flowers to a heap of them at the back of the cemetery. Stench of rotting foliage and foul green water smothering my senses. But the cemetery was large and green and treed. It did not frighten me. I knew it only in the bright light of summer, in the company of my dad. I like Mexican cemeteries best after the dead have left on the third day at the tolling of the church bells. Flat tombstones covered with spent red and yellow flowers, gutted candles, scraps of food left over from meals taken at gravesides, all testimony to the affection families feel for Los Antepasados. My father was a quiet man. He left quietly and did not, as far as I know, visit again. My mother, who always had to be heard, did come back once during Semana Santa. Semana Santa. I was the only person in the street on that quiet Good Friday until you came, suddenly, with your rush of energy, your tough spirit. My steps slowed, my throat tightened. You left me with less breath. I stopped, started again, then turned toward home. You chose well, a quiet time in a town that is seldom quiet. But I could not make you stay. I tried for a block or two before giving in, before letting you fade. Mexico, of course, it had to be Mexico. You knew you'd find me there. This is called The Bend in the Road. Anybody who's been with me in Oaxaca knows that I want my ashes spread under this tree, you know. And it's a beautiful little acacia tree out in the countryside in the valley of Oaxaca. So there's two words in here, guarida, which is kind of Mexican slang for white woman, although it's used as kind of a term of endearment, and milpa, which is a field of corn. There is a great bend in the road that leads to San Marcos de la Pozola. From the vantage point of the vulture, high up in the thermals, the road is a white line tracking through fields of green agave toward the lone acacia tree. At the tree, the road takes a turn west, toward the foothills of the Sierra Madre and the distant Pueblo. She always slows at the bend to have full view of the tree before rounding the curve. That is where I want my ashes spread. Friends take note and nod. That is the spot. And they drive on to the rugged little town and buy red pottery from the women there. She walks through the field of green agave, small clouds of red dust trailing her and places a weary hand on the trunk of the old acacia. The road has been widened, and so the tree is now closer to the great bend. And with further widening, there may not be a tree. But it is here now, and it will be when they come with the ashes. She wants to feel steady with that thought. She watches the vultures circle against the intense blue of the sky, then looks across the gentle slope of the valley with its milpas toward Oaxaca, tries hard not to forget the old city. She lived in Mexico for many winters, happy to abandon ice and snow forever. She was never at home in the northern cold, even as a child, but neither did she harbor illusions of being at home in Mexico. She knew she was an outsider, a guerrita. This does not lessen her attachment to the place or to her fading desire to linger near the tree. How much time in this dry breeze and shade? How long to register the pueblo in the foothills or the shadow of the vulture crossing the milpa? How long to recall that small, serious child who was so suddenly old? This is called Casa Divina, and this is a little poem about a hotel south of the Zocalo. And it's a place I pass almost every morning when I go out for my early morning walk. And you probably know in Mexico, houses are behind walls. So there's walls along the street, and often those properties are separated just by color. Richard knows this well because he's done a lot of photography in Oaxaca. And sometimes those colors are extremely bright. There's a reference in here to La Llorona, who is, she's the weeping woman in Mexican song and also in the Mexican myth. And there's a reference to banderitas, which are those small flags that they string across the street for a feast. Casa Divina, small hotel on a rundown street far from the best part of town, attired in Pepto-Bismol pink, like a young woman the morning after a bad date. Like an old woman who still likes to dress up but can't quite pull it off. There is something about you I admire, Divina, distinguished among the well-worn of your street. Dawn rays dappling through banderitas strung high for a feast. What passes beyond flaking walls, Divina? Lies gladdened and tarnished. La Llorona, old cantina in the back. The weeping woman, the ordinary. I will come to visit at night, Divina, when candlelight covers your scars, when music and soft air and scent of spring blossoms repair battered hearts, when patrons toast lovers and their lovers past. And this is about battered hearts. It was written quite a long time ago, and it's called Painkiller. Fill my cup again, won't you, and fall with me through stardust, making love along the way like drunken angels trying to recall bliss. Let's pretend again we know the way, our hearts repaired with gin and olives, and tumble together through starlight, and stop only to dance the slow ones. I just want to read you one more. This is a recent poem, but it's not in the book, but it's about Oaxaca, about Oaxaca's street dogs. Street dogs, as you probably know, are often very badly cared for in third world countries. But I just noticed in the last few years in Oaxaca, people are taking care of them. And they're lovely. You know, they become part of the neighborhood and people get to know them. There's a reference to La Iglesia de Carmen Alto, which is one of the prominent churches in Oaxaca, of which there are many. And La Anciana, which is the old woman or the ancient one. Street dogs of Oaxaca. I like a town where dogs live comfortably on the street, the kind of town where shop owners leave a bowl of water by the door, a bit of kibble, a place where someone slips an old t-shirt over the animal when it's cold, leaves him undisturbed in the shade when it's hot. I like a town where I see a man on a bench apologize to a street dog because he just finished the sandwich and didn't save any for his canine friend. Has to look into those deep dog eyes and admit it's gone. I like a town where a small dog decides to follow me right across the city to the fish market. Her nails clicking the sidewalk all the way. I like the way she waits outside the shop, careful not to offend as I choose the fish. The way she sticks with me as we retrace our steps and presses up against my calf as I take a shortcut through an alley she doesn't trust. I like dogs who look at me quizzically when I speak English, whose eyes brighten when I speak Spanish, dog talk in Espanol. I like the big black dog who lies quietly by Elena, la anciana who sells fruit near La Iglesia de Carmen Alto. Elena is old and loved on her corner near Carmen Alto by her loyal customers, by the big black dog who keeps an eye. An American friend told me that according to accredited sources, Mexicans are happier than Americans, and that Mexican dogs are happier than American dogs. And further, that if American dogs hang out with Mexican dogs, they are happier. Thank you very much.
I think we're all happier having heard Linda and Callie read. I was struck not only by the beauty of their words, but how utterly eloquent they are as readers. We're going to have a few more minutes. We have a chance to make comments or ask questions. But before we do that, can we just clap again? And Callie, would you stand up? So you go stand safely behind the desk. I'll jump in if I have to moderate the crowd. But I'm assuming we can just do it popcorn style. If you have a question, go for it. Pop up.
I have to ask Callie whether you sent Michael Crummy your poem. Did you?
Did I what?
Send Michael Crummy
no,
your
I,
poem.
No, I didn't.
I bet he'd love to see it.
I would like to know where to send it. I know it's St. John's, but I don't know where. But I have.
Oh, they'll know who he is.
You could probably send it like through Riddle Fence or something like that. Yeah.
Or you could just send it to his house. I'll help you creep him. Yeah. We'll figure out where it is.
I don't want him to feel stalked, you know. Right. But I did ask a poet friend who has a lot more experience than I if she thought, you know, that it was taking liberties. And she said, no, I think he'd be very fine with that.
And it's too late anyway.
Well, too late now. Yeah.
Give him time.
So, Linda, has anybody asked you to have these poems translated into Spanish?
No, I haven't thought of that.
I mean, it would be a challenge, but do you have any poet friends in Oaxaca?
Yes, I write with a group in Oaxaca. And, you know, and I do know people who could do the translation. Mm. Yeah, that would be a nice idea.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sure. Wow.
There we go, Rena.
I shudder. That would be quite wonderful, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same time next year?
Same time next year, yeah.
So, Linda, are you going to be doing another book? Because you read another poem from... I know once you publish something, you always keep producing more work. And
uh-huh.
Are you going towards another one?
Yeah, I'm working on a collection of very short prose pieces, like micro prose. Yeah, so that's I was working on something.
Yeah, that one sounds very much like a flash fiction piece, the piece you read.
The dog one,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I like the injection of humor.
The dogs are great.
You're both writing from place, which obviously makes sense. But it's interesting to hear, Linda, your voice does change whether it's in Oaxaca or whether it's in Kingston. I mean, I think your heart is so deeply in Oaxaca, and a lot of the poems seem very much coming from that landscape. Mm-hmm. I assume both of you have also lived in other places and traveled in other places as adults. Do you occasionally try to write in other places as well, or did you deliberately decide to limit yourself in these books to Kingston and Oaxaca?
Oh, well, in mine, no, they're all over the place.
Oh, they are, okay.
I just decided to read a range that was set here because we're here tonight.
Okay.
So they aren't all, but they're not all place poems either. Some mm-hmm. are very much about a place, but others are about other things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really about place specifically.
Yeah, and I think I, you know, all my life I've kind of taken notes wherever I was, and so I think it comes just from observing things in different places. But for this collection, I wanted it deliberately to go back and forth between here and Oaxaca.
Do you find your vocabulary changes other than being English and Spanish? But do you find the way you use language in those places is different?
I think that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe not the way I use language, but I suppose I probably write the same. But yes, I think the words and the language does come out a bit differently depending on. What do you think? When you write?
I'm asking.
Oh, I love that turnaround. Also, both former teachers, right? What do you think?
I don't want to talk anymore. No, it's just the rhythm seems to be so much of the place. That's why, for both of you, and that's why I was asking.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I imagine there's a difference between living in a place and visiting a place, right?
Yes.
Because you live in Oaxaca and you live in Kingston.
Yeah, that's right.
As opposed to visiting. Spain or Cuba or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah, yeah,
so it's
exactly.
Time, and also you bring your personal stuff to it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's a big difference when you spend a lot of time in a place. And I feel so fond of both places. Because when I first started going to Mexico, my friends would say to me, well, which do you like better? And I hated that question. Mm-hmm. And I always said, well, they're just different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But over time, I found that I really love them both. Right now, I'm really looking forward to going to Oaxaca next week.
I wonder why.
Yeah, these two know a lot about Oaxaca. And then in the spring, I really look forward to coming back to Kingston in Eastern Ontario. I love living here.
So, Kelly, I've read Linda's before I came, but I haven't read yours. So just looking at this delightful piece, Convo with the Falconer.
Yeah.
And it's the only one in the book, as far as I can see, that has this extraordinary format.
There's another one. There's another one called, there's another one about the ocean. I forget whether I ended up calling it ocean. If I did, my editor probably wanted me to say, like, how the waves in the ocean. I can't find it now, but it's like that too. And yeah. There are two of them.
Yeah, but so it makes reading so much different.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it
makes writing so much different.
Oh,
and there's another
show
one.
Show them, Kelly.
If I can find it.
Well, this is on page 48, know. The one
page
I'm
48.
Referring to.
Oh, okay. Here it is.
Anyway, it seemed to be the only one like that. And
oh, yeah, okay, so that one looks like this. Mm. And so then you really have to, it's like in any other constraint, the substance of the poem, you know, the content is really the important part, but it has to be constrained a little bit to get it to do what you want it to mm-hmm. do in the space. So it's different writing it, but they're kind of fun. And challenging, and you might not end up writing it the same way at all if you weren't trying to meet that form.
So it's not it's a chicken and egg thing. Did you decide on the format first and have the words fit the format, or did it flow this way?
It it must have started to go that way, and then I thought, well, why not be slavish about it? And then there are two more in here that are really like that. One of them is a silly poem about how a grain of sand becomes a pearl, and I did something with that, but it does change the content. It doesn't always flow quite the same way.
So there's the other one on page 34, maybe, how time and experience makes smooth the edges of the poem.
That would be the ocean, formerly.
Oh, yeah.
Pre-editor.
Oh, yeah, there it is right there.
Yeah.
It's probably the silliest poem in the book. But there is one about the ocean in here, and it goes like that, or I forget which way it goes. But, yeah, I think it goes like that, yeah. And they're fun. They're fun to the form poems are sort of fun to write.
There's a writing prompt I've given students for years of writing a story that starts with a sentence of 26 words, and each subsequent sentence has one last word.
Oh yeah.
And so as you're getting to the very meat of the story, you're reduced and reduced and reduced to fewer and fewer words, and it's really fun, actually. I think
It is. It probably creates some differences in the way you have to say something. And you might have to, you know, frame something in a very particular way, whereas if it's just free verse, you don't quite have that constraint. I think there was a young novelist who wrote a major award-winning book a few years ago, and she had every chapter was half the wordage as the chapter before. Mm-hmm. So the last chapter is really small, and I it was a big book, so that must have been really challenging. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like that.
And it's also interesting, these forms, because you don't see them when they're reading.
No.
And true. I was struck by, I've seen the written poems that Linda has 1,000 times, but it's the first time I've ever heard her read them out loud, and they're completely different. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of
interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about margins. it was a really special experience.
Oh, great.
So I have one more comment. It's interesting you talked about this poem about sand turning into a pearl.
Yes.
And one of the images that Linda has in that poem she read, Through the Glass, was when she talks about the green windblown surface with a layer of pearl.
Yeah.
And I know exactly what that looks like.
Yeah.
But if you hadn't grown up maybe around water, you would think, what is that?
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful image.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Which you would know very well.
I know.
You've seen that.
Yeah. That's great, girl. That was wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
And excuse me, and you just heard from an October 10th lunch and reading event at Novel Idea, Linda Wild with her book, The Weight of Two Oranges, and Calista Markotich with her book, Wrap in a Big White Towel. And my heartfelt thanks as we get near the end of this hour. It is 58 minutes after 4 o'clock for tuning in. I also want to thank the poets and Novel Idea and Rena and for everything that was there that night. So tell you what, let's do this, and you'll see that we're just starting our funding drive, but let me do this and I'll be right back.
Hello, CFRC listeners. This is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca.
Attention all musicians and production companies. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KCFF, and the Kingston Music Office are thrilled to announce the fourth edition of the Slate Music Video Program. Local film production companies will receive financing to create new music videos featuring Kingston's top musical artists, with a special focus on emerging talent. All greenlit